Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, welcome to another Rahalastapa with the fantastic Les Dennis. This is a really special and beautiful one, and I know you are going to enjoy it. Hey, check out rahalastapa.co.uk, my fan friends, and you can get all sorts of benefits. And you can see stuff about the podcast, you can pay a little bit of money and get behind-the-scenes access and get ad-free podcasts, imagine that. And loads more stuff. Also go to richchang.com/gigs and you can see where I'm touring. There's loads of fantastic tour dates coming up. Warwick Arts Centre, I'm at King's Place in King's Cross in June with some big name guests. I'm in Henley with the wonderful Barry Cryer and much more. And then I'm in Edinburgh on the 2nd to the 25th of August at 1:30 p.m. at the Newtown Theatre. Please come and see that. I'll be talking to a different guest every day. All of those will be podcasted in audio format for you to enjoy at home. And then the tour continues into the autumn and probably into 2020 and long, long after that until finally I die. And it'll continue after that as well. I don't need to be here, as you will remember from the Brian Blessed episode. Anyway, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy Leslie Dennis on Rahalastapa. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. You're already much better than last week's audience. Will you please welcome a man who has literally just made up this introduction right now. That's how amazing the ad-lib he is. It's Richard Herring! Lovely to see you. Welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. It's nice to have you back. Some of you were here last week. Not this guy with the plaster on his finger. I don't know what happened. I don't know where he came from. So we do a lot of banter before the actual show that the people at home must. I wish I was here. You could come down and see the shows. They're great. Go to richherring.com/gigs. Ha ha. Bad luck, people who skip through the intro. Ha ha ha. You probably skip through this bit as well. Anyway, welcome. Welcome. I'll have to do it when the guest's on. Welcome to a podcast called Richard Herring's Lobbing Small Snail Tentacles Podcast. You'd think I wouldn't be running out of ideas so fast. It's a podcast where we take the tentacles off snails and then see who can throw them the furthest. It's just a new idea. It's a very crowded market, the podcast market. No one else is doing that, but I was playing badminton with some of the kids who had notes from the doctor saying they didn't have to do proper games. And they call it Rahalastapa, so I don't know if that's going to catch on. So good. Yeah, I was, I was going to do, I haven't really thought what this routine's going to be, and I'm kind of slightly worried about it because my wife listens to this show. But I saw a guy saying he was a happily married man, right? And I kind of thought that's kind of a weird thing to say, isn't it? Because you never hear anyone say, you know, I'm, you know, it was all right. So you don't need to say I'm a happily married man. You either, no one, you, when you're married, even if you're not happy, you don't say, and even if you're unhappy, you still say you're happily married. I think more if you're unhappy, you say I'm a happily married person. There's no need. I'm a married person. It has its ups and downs. That's the truth. I'm a quite happily married. So if anyone says that I'm a happily married man or woman, be suspicious of them. I'm a very happily married man, though, if my wife's listening. She knows the truth. Let's have a little chat. We'll have a quick chat with the audience before we bring. We've got a fantastic guest this week. I don't want to waste my time. I'm just trying to look for a new. Look at this guy. Now, he is. You are one of the cool kids. He's got one of those earrings that's like a big round plastic thing that goes through. That is that. I should have. You're going to be in the next week's intro, mate. So, what's your name?
Carl,
that's a cool name, isn't it? And he's got a partner he's holding hands with. It's very exciting. Hey, what do you do for a living, Carl?
I work at a castle.
You work at a castle? Which castle is it?
It's called Hurstman Zoo Castle.
Hurstman Zoo's castle?
Hurstman Zoo Castle.
Hurstman Zoo Castle. Is that in the UK?
It's in Sussex.
It's in Sussex. What kind of stuff's in the castle?
Not a lot.
Not a lot. What's your job there? Are you a soldier?
I work on the estate.
You work on the estate. You're kind of doing gardening and stuff.
Well,
cutting down trees.
Gardens.
You do the outside the what?
I work outside the garden.
You work outside the gardens. What, staring in at the gardens? Going one day. Is there a maze you have to get through to get in there? Is that the problem? You're building a maze next year. Is that your job? That's very exciting. And who's this charming young lady you're with? Your girlfriend, you're quite new to each other because you seemed like you're holding hands and stuff. How long have you been together? Jen, how long have you been together, Jenny?
Since June.
That's ages. What's going on with you two? That's weird, isn't it? Have you had sex yet? Yeah, twice. Good work, mate. Good luck. Don't get married. If you get married, don't have kids. Have you got kids? You got kids? Yeah.
Five grandchildren.
You got five grandchildren? Wow, good work. Good work. Good work, Jenny. But in every sense. I mean, there's obviously some terrible story where you got pregnant when you were 11. It's fine. It's good. That's good. It's still good. Still good. That's allowed in Sussex anyway. So it's... Well done to you both. I think... Can we just bump the guests and we'll just talk to these... What gold. So look, I'm very, very excited about this guest this week. I've been trying to get him on for a long time because, like me, you will know him best from his... appearance as an audience member at the British Soap Awards in 2014. But he's also known for hosting quite a famous game show, The Grid. I don't know if you remember that from Channel 5. We all love The Grid. Will you please welcome Les Dennis, ladies and gentlemen? It's Les Dennis! Les Dennis.
Thank you.
How you doing, Les?
I'm good. What are all these people doing in your front room? In the Grid, it was called.
In the Grid?
In the Grid.
Oh, yeah. Of course it was. That
and
makes
it was
sense.
Fascinating.
Now. What happened in the Grid?
I can't remember. We did four a day for quite a long time.
It's like that, isn't it?
It was Channel 5 show.
Channel 5, I think
so.
Yeah,
it was Channel 5 show. And it was up against It Takes Two, so it didn't have much of a chance on it. Because you don't put I think they learned that those kind of game shows now you put into the 5 o'clock slot, not the 6:30 slot.
Okay.
But Richard Osman produced it.
Did he?
There you go.
I must get him back on to talk about it.
Yeah.
Well, look, it's fantastic. There's so much that we could talk about, Les, and let's start with, my goodness, this is what I want to know about you.
Yeah.
Now, in Norwich, the name Les Dennis has been spray-painted over many, many walls in huge capital letters. Yeah. Who did that, Les? And well, it's time for you.
It's funny because like I saw it on Twitter and I'd seen it a few times and I thought somebody's just kind of put it together, you know, what do you call it, CGI,
yeah,
that thing. So
it's definitely CGI.
What do you call it?
You know, spray paint.
No, when you put it on, make it
Photoshop.
Photoshop. That's Photoshop, a word. Granddad. Sorry.
I didn't know. I couldn't think of it either.
I'm a little senior moment there. But basically, so I thought, and then somebody said, no, it's for real. So I then tweeted saying, I didn't do it, you know, which made me sound like Shaggy. It wasn't me. So, and it kind of then went viral. And
yeah.
I think Norwich local news picked it up and ran with it. And then... it just seemed to become... I think it ended up on Have I Got News For You. They discussed it as well. But, you know, obviously somebody... some artist, Wanksy, maybe.
Are the Les Dennis...
Certainly not Banksy.
Are the Les Dennis's worth anything? Are they people putting them behind perspex?
Well, apparently now, in another town, it's Bobby Davro. They moved on to Bobby Davro. So it's kind of, maybe it's a post-impressionist thing.
Yeah, it could be. We don't allow jokes on this show. We do not approve of jokes.
But somebody as well told me that there's one in London, because I did a play at the Finsbury Park last year,
yeah.
And the manager there said, look, there's this one outside our...
It's a youth craze. It's a new craze. Yeah, yeah. Kids going around writing your name on walls leads to worse things. It leads to Bobby Davro. That's not something anyone wants. So look, I mean, you've been in the business for a very long time.
A long time, yeah.
Like you started as a 17-year-old, or were you even younger?
Yeah,
than that?
1971. I did my first telly. Which was Opportunity Knocks,
right.
The old, you know, the talent show with when Huey Green was hosting it before Bob Monkhouse. People might, I should imagine. Does anybody remember Huey Green?
Yeah. With the...
Yeah, the Huey Green, he was the presenter of Opportunity Knocks. But talking about the kind of the talent show in the days when you didn't vote by phone, you had to send a postcard in. You had to write down who you thought your top three were.
Yeah.
And then on the Friday, then the producer would ring you up and say, sorry, Les, like they did. They rang me and said, sorry, Les, you came fourth.
Oh.
Which I think they probably said to everybody who came either fourth, fifth or sixth,
yeah.
You know, because they only announced the top three.
Sure.
So that was my first telly.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you were doing the clubs in Liverpool with your mum taking you around?
I was doing the working men's clubs, yeah.
Yeah, so that's an incredible
still
circuit.
At school. I was still at school, yeah.
Yeah. So you were on. I saw your This Is Your Life you did in the 90s, and one of your teachers was there and said you wouldn't go to a rehearsal to a play, and he let you go because you were earning more than he was in a year for your one night of doing this stand-up.
Yeah, well, you know, kind of, it was funny because I was at school with an amazing group of people. I was at school with Clive Barker, the horror writer.
Right.
And Jude Kelly, who went on to run West Yorkshire Playhouse.
Yes.
And then South Bank. And Steve Coppell, the footballer, and, you know, kind of like... So it was a real kind of hotbed of football and the arts.
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't know whether I was going to go down the drama route and become an actor or go down the working men's clubs route. And my mum knew somebody she worked with. She worked at Lucas's aerospace factory. And a mate of hers said, I'll give Les his expenses... to do 10 minutes between the two acts on a Saturday night, and one of the acts was a local comic called Jackie Hamilton, who I later did a play about Jackie Hamilton. I did a show which I think was probably in Edinburgh when you were there called Jigsy,
yes,
which was a one man play about this comedian Jackie Hamilton. So I had to go on after him, and he was a legend in Liverpool. He's one of those kind of like comics that never got out of his own He was very parochial. He never got outside of Liverpool. I think he did the Comedians once. But he was, like, just a funny, funny man. You know, he had funny bones. He was an extra on Tenko.
Right.
Which, if you remember, anybody who remembers it, it was a drama. Stephanie Cole, I think, was in it. Stephanie Beecham.
I think so, yeah.
And it was set in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. And Jackie Hamilton was one of the extras in it. And in the afternoon, the director was kind of like arranging everybody for a scene. And he went, hang on a minute, I can't have you. Look at you. You've got a beer belly. You've got a boozy nose. You stink of whiskey. You can't be a prisoner of war. And Jackie said, I was only captured yesterday. Which is just great, isn't it? So they kept him and they put him at the back. But he kind of like... He used to do, like, he'd stand there and say, you know, you look at that pint of mild. You can't get a decent pint of mild these days, except in the wine lodges. Me and Arnie and Dick the Docker and Archie were all down the wine lodge the other night. And Archie said, you're not looking your usual cheerful self. I said, well, I've got to have a vasectomy, haven't I? He said, well, you haven't got to. I said, I have. She said that she's going to divorce me if I don't have one. He said, well, have you tried talking to her about it? He said, well, yeah, we've been arguing about it for weeks. The other night, I went out for a pint, and her and the kids had a vote as to whether I should have one or not. And I lost 13-12. So, you know... He did the wife jokes, but he didn't do them in. He did them in a kind of really loving way. It wasn't kind of like a. He was an old fashioned, brilliant stand up who, you know, didn't survive. But so I went on. Sorry, I went on and did my 10 minutes for the concert secretary that my mum knew, and I was working. I had a Saturday job in a do it yourself shop where I was working all day lugging tiles up and down the stairs, and I got a pound. For my wages for the one day on a Saturday, and I came off and the guy said, "Well, there you go, Jackie Hamilton. He's already well established on the show, and there's that young lad starting on the first rung of the ladder." I always remember that, thinking, "Oh right, I'm on the first rung of the ladder." So I came off, and he came up to me and said, "Here's your expenses," and he gave me £2.
Right.
So I thought, £2 for 10 minutes. This works. So that's when I started doing the working men's clubs and loved it, you know.
But it was it tough because they were quite rough.
Yeah,
clubs
yeah, and... you know, kind of like at first they were kind of like, oh, he's only young, you know. I mean, sometimes you'd get to the door of the working men's club and it was that kind of like cloth cap and the kind of like you're not coming in. I'm the comic. You're not coming in unless you pay your two shillings
right.
to get in. But I'm the comedian. No, you're not. Not your age. You're not the kid. So I had to pay £2 to get in, go in, do the job. And, you know, sometimes, he's a young lad and he's doing impressions. But then, you know, once you started doing the circuit, it was like, no, you know, we're paying him money for this. And, like, I had a concert chairman who said that he had to lock himself in his room in his office for the complaints. And another time I remember on a stage like this, kind of like you always dreaded if you couldn't get out of the dressing room at the back, if you couldn't go out that way, because if you didn't do well, if you died, you would have to walk across the stage and, you know, walk through them while they're playing bingo. And me and my dad had to walk through, my dad carrying my props. My dad used to get embarrassed if I hadn't done well. He loved, you know, what I did, but he was just a very sensitive man. So we're walking across, and as we're walking down, this guy, we're in Preston, and this guy called me over. He said, they were terrible. And I thought, I went, thank God somebody who knows that it wasn't me, it was the audience. And I said, they were, weren't they? They were terrible. He went, no, not they, they were terrible. You know, I had curtains closed on me. I had, you know, a concert chairman saying, come off, Bonnie lad, don't punish yourself. And I came off and he said, well, you know, like, lads, I'm sorry, because I'd emptied the room. It was a darts do, and I was going on, you know, it was all fellas, and within 10 minutes I had emptied the room. I was doing Frank Spencer and all this, and I'm going, what the... And so I came off and he said, don't punish yourself. And as I was leaving, he said, well, you know, you've got to say, on telly, he's all right, but live, he's crap. So you know, I had all those dates, and you know, Dustin G. I worked in a double act with Dustin G. And you know, I remember him once going on stage and just deciding, because if you did badly in a club, if you had two spots after you'd done your first spot, they'd come off, and the concert chairman would say, "I'm paying you off," which is meaning give you half your money.
Right.
Dustin one night was on stage and he just looked at them and said, "I'm paying you off. You're a terrible audience. I'm going to pay you off." So he kind of did that to the audience. And then he said, "I'm going to get home tonight." He said, "I live in Cemetery Road in Swindon. I'm going to walk upstairs, open the curtains, look across and say, 'You think you bastards died?'" So he was a funny man.
Yeah.
I was
watching some of the laughter show that's on YouTube.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and he's I mean, you're both, it's a very interesting show.
Yeah.
I mean there's so much to talk about. But you know, because obviously this is 1986 as well.
Yeah.
So it's quite a traditional show in lots of ways.
Yeah.
So there's lots of things that resonate back with you know, there's a variety of stuff. There's sort of a hot gossipy dance troupe in it, and there's a little barbershop quartet doing a sort of weird thing about blowing out a candle. But what's interesting, and you know, there's some very light entertainment sort of trad stuff. But what's interesting is you're mixing it up. Even in the one or two I saw, Dustin does a Peter Cook impression, and it's quite Peter Cook sort of material.
Yeah, he loved Peter Cook.
Yeah, and you're doing a routine with Arthur Scargill and Derek Hatton.
Yes.
You know, which you wouldn't again expect in the middle of a live
entertainment
show.
And it's kind of like just these last few weeks it's been posted again.
Yeah.
Like it's topical again, kind of.
There's a real, and both of you, you can see the talent there, but it's obviously, he died very tragically young. In his 40s, was he?
He was 43. We met on the Russ Abbott show. We'd kind of briefly met on Who Do You Do, which was an impressionist show that Freddie Starr and Little and Large and loads of impressionists were on. And then we worked on the Russ Abbott show. I remember kind of before we worked on that, I'd been booked to be on the show, the series, the Russ Abbott Madhouse, at LWT, London Weekend Television. And I didn't have anywhere to stay. And I had the same manager as Dustin. And he said, "Well, you know, call Dustin." And, you know, because I knew he rents a flat in London. So I called him and he said, "Yeah, I'll come and see you at the Panto." And he came, I was in Panto with Russ that Christmas. And he came and he knocked on my dressing room door. And this very tall, very good looking, very, like, he had movie star look, you know, kind of very imposing guy, stood there at the door with a bottle of Liebfraumilch and said, "I come bearing gifts." And he really did, you know, because he came into my life. I was a rookie comic. He was already a star. You know, those acts that can establish themselves in the club world without any television. He was like that, you know, kind of like the Mike Hardings and, you know, and Ronnie Dukes and Ricky Lee were a big act that could, you know, fill clubs without any television exposure. And Dustin was that kind of act. And then when we got together in the Russ Abbott show and we started doing the Vera and Mavis, you know, that's where it just... Then the producers gave us lots of sketches as Vera Mavis and then other things. It just kind of clicked. And he was willing, as somebody who'd already established himself, to become a double act with a rookie young comic.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, so generous of him.
Yeah.
Amazingly generous.
Yeah, Well, it's an interesting time because, you know, you've got, we were saying this backstage, but you've got, you know, you started in the early 70s and it was, you know, I think you were on The Comedians a couple of times, were you? And
I was on it once.
One time,
yeah. And I was the youngest comedian ever to go on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember being, I was 18 and I remember going to the recording, Johnny Hamp saying, "Well, you're going on, you'll be on quite late because all the other comics are going to go off and do their gig."
Yeah.
So, like, you know, I had to go on 10th, you know, after Bernard Manning.
Yeah.
I was 18. After Bernard Manning, after Frank Carson, after, they were all there. Ken Goodwin, did some names some of you will know and some of you won't know. Lovely Jim Bowen. And, you know, so I had to go on right at the end of the night. And you know, you're going, that joke's gone. But it didn't really, as it happened, I couldn't do any of those. Because I was 18, I was doing jokes about my mum and dad. yeah. and about my sister and my brother, you know. Yeah. So, and I got one joke on that show. So.
Well, they're sort of ticking them off the jokes off a board at the
yeah,
back.
Yeah, you go, and there they go, there's the, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you're just, yeah. everyone's sort of doing the same yeah. material. Yeah. It's sort of, because at the 80s, obviously, as a comedy fan, and the thing what's interesting for me as a comedy fan, I was, you know, I remember watching The Comedians.
Yeah.
I remember watching all the Russ Abbott stuff.
Yeah.
I remember loving Cannon and Ball, like when I was, right. you know, 7 or 8. And then, like, The Young Ones and all that sort of stuff hit. Yeah. As I became a teenager,
yeah.
and you were working at the same time as the Young Ones, doing yeah. quite a trad show that was.
We had to keep our head down in the 80s. Anybody that was establishment. I remember one time going to the BBC. Always had a light entertainment Christmas party.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I went along and just like I was the only one I didn't know. You know, they're just kind of like looking and going, wow, you know, there's Ronnie Barker, the, you know, the two Ronnies and everybody from the establishment side, but also, you know, Rick and French and Saunders and Ben Elton. And what was really interesting at the beginning of the evening, you know, kind of the wine and the food is all over here. But there was one side over here, you know, kind of like the establishment side. And over here was the, as they were labelled, alternative side. So, but nobody talking until Barry Cryer, the Kofi Annan of comedy, comes in the middle and just says, come on, guys. And then once we got talking, we realised that kind of the war was more media-based than it was, you know. I mean, there were some, I look back, there are some things that I look back and go, whoa, shouldn't have done that. We shouldn't, you know, there's a couple of times, I think, in where I think we did an EastEnders sketch and Dustin blacked up. But, you know, in the 80s, we're talking, you know. Yeah. And, you know, with the knowledge of that, we wouldn't do that now, and I certainly wouldn't do that now. But, you know, it was a time where there were things that, you know, I would hopefully say that on the whole we weren't kind of non-PC, you know, but some people were. So so our the mainstream comics got a bit of a bad name at that time, you know.
But what's interesting, I think, when you look back at all that 70s stuff, I mean, I talked to the Goodies recently and Monty Python as well, they were all doing the same thing. So and you know, and it went on longer as well, even though the alternative stuff came along. But I think what's interesting is the way that some comedians didn't get over that wall.
Yeah.
Some of those comedians from The Comedians couldn't work in the 80s or lost the star in the 80s. But you found your way through that. I think because, you know, you weren't doing overtly horrible stuff in any of your act. But also, you weathered that to work out. I think you've done this your whole career, haven't you? You've managed
I did the Addams Family a couple of years ago, and one of the most proud things, I think, I just loved it. In The Guardian, it said, in the long and strange career of Les Dennis, he makes yet another left turn. But I thought, well, you know, that's fine. I'll take that any day, you know.
To be able to work for 40 or 50 years in this business is insane, right?
Yeah,
you know,
it's
so difficult.
Yeah.
To stay at that level, going up and down at the level, stay at a high level all the way through is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that there's something there.
Yeah.
In you that makes that possible, and that's and when you do look back at the whole thing, I know there's obviously times you've been through where it's been more difficult, but when you have the chance to look back at the whole thing, it's absolutely incredible what you've achieved and the people you've worked with and the things you've done.
People say, oh, about Tommy Cooper, I say I worked with him, and they were like, what? And I not only I worked with him when I was 20 years old in Liverpool. And I did a week at the Shakespeare Theatre Club with him, which was a kind of variety kind of theatre club where, you know, they had a big star and then a singer and a young comic or whatever. And I was the young comic that week. And I remember on the Monday sitting there in my dressing room thinking, right, I've got to go and do my band rehearsal. I wonder if I'll get to meet him, you know. And I'm sitting in my dressing room, and then this kind of weird bloke with the longest hair down here and a pair of Bermuda shorts just walked into my room and went, "Aya." He said, "I just thought I'd put this on. I wanted to try something visual." And I was like, okay. And he was just funny, you know. Yeah. He was funny and just the minute you just saw him, he was funny. I mean, there's a lovely story about Tommy, like when he was in the Guards and he was on duty one night and he was standing on duty and he was falling asleep. And he's gone off like that. And he opened his eyes and his commanding officer stood in front of him and Tommy just went, "Amen." And at the end of the week, he said, "Are you going to stay for a drink?" And I went, "Yeah, good." And he was notorious for, you know, sitting in a bar at the end of the show until 6 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
You know, I mean, he liked to drink, Tommy. And I think I gave up at three and he went, "Don't get too funny." But I remember that night that it got to about 3 o'clock and he was like, "The bar's closed," because there was a grill. You know the grills they bring down? And he was like, "I can't get another drink." And there was this doorman called Arthur. He said, "Don't worry about that, Tommy, I'll sort it." And he brought out a bamboo pole, a long bamboo pole with like a little hook on the end. He said, "What do you want, Tommy?" He said, "Our scotch." He went, "Right, it's 7 o'clock, 7 across, 3 up. And he put this bamboo through the grill to the optic at the back, up like that, and the drink came down to the bottom. And that was, you know, for the rest of the night. And I think I want this story to be so true. He came home to his house one night with Dennis Kirkland, his producer, of the Tommy Cooper show that he did, the Thames. And if he came home on his own, his wife Dawn would say, his wife Dove would say, "Get to bed, you're not drinking on your own all night." If he came home with a mate, she wouldn't mind him sitting up and having a drink. So he comes home one night and says, "Dove, I'm home," shouted up. She went, "Hello, Tom. I brought Dennis back for a drink." She went, "Hello, Dennis." And Dennis went, "Hello, Dove. Lovely show tonight. Tommy was brilliant." "I was brilliant tonight. It said I was brilliant." "That's great. Have a lovely drink. Thanks. Good night, Dove. Good night. Good night, Dove." So Dennis and Tommy then sit there and Tommy's like, "What do you have to drink, Dennis?" He says, "I'll have what you're having, Tommy." He says, "I'm going to have a scotch." He said, "Well, I'll have the same as you. Large one?" "Large one." So they sit there and they're talking about the show. "Great show. It was a great show. You were great tonight, Tommy. Fantastic." And the more they drank, the more the voices merged. "I thought you were absolutely fantastic. You were so good. You're the best I'd ever seen." He'd come home on his own. And he wanted to drink. So he played the two parts like he used to do with those hats.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Dove went, "Get up to bed, you lying bastard." And then I worked with him on the night that he died.
Yes, I did know that. Yeah.
Myself and Dustin were the next act on after Tommy. And we'd been at the rehearsals all that day and, you know, Tommy had done, you know, so many, been funny and never done the same thing twice. I remember he had this... The end of his act was that he had the tabs in, and it was one of those shows where it was all glitzy light bulbs, but he had the tabs in because he was doing this routine, like the big red curtains here behind us, and he put on a cloak and he was pulling things out of a cloak like, you know, magic. But clearly, they started small, you know, lampshade and then a coffee table and then step ladders and all sorts. But clearly, they're being fed through from the. But which is just Tommy and funny. And, you know, he just got the cloak on and he collapsed to the floor. And we were in the wings. We stood in the wings just over there like that looking. And David Bell, the producer, is there. And he turns to Tommy Jr., Tommy's son, and said, "Is that a joke?" And he said, "No, my dad's got a bad back. He'd never be able to get up again." And because the audience are laughing. Because, you know... He was a funny man. He was getting laughs in, you know, his dying moments. And we didn't know, you know. And so David Bell just coolly went, "Cue commercial, cue music, cue commercial break." And the music played. And then Jimmy Tarbuck and David Bell were on stage chatting about it, and we thought, well, that's it, they'll just pull the show and put something on, because behind here, they've moved in behind the curtains, and, you know, the paramedics are racing on to, you know, check, you know, what's happening. And they wouldn't move him until, well, they wouldn't move until the paramedics had got there. So then they turned to us and say, you ready to go on? And we're like, what? And, you know, the commercial break ended, and we came on and did our act in front of that those curtains, yeah, yeah. You know, kind of. And you're nervous before about the idea that you've got to go and follow Tommy Cooper. But when something like that happens, the nerves go, and you just know that you're having to hold the fort, you know, yeah. And carry on. It was an extraordinary moment, really.
Yeah, well, you know? I mean, you've had these moments. You've worked, you know, after your parents have died, you worked those nights, you carried on.
Well, Dustin said that night, he said, you know, that's the way I'd like to go. Dustin said, you know, with my boots on. And 2 years later, be careful what you wish for, because 2 years later, he collapsed in a dressing room as we're doing Panto, and was then in a coma for 2 days and died on the 3rd of January 1986.
Yeah.
You know? And I miss him to this day, you know? He was a funny, funny man, you know, just a lovely, funny man, and, you know, a great company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we actually met this year at the Stan and Ollie. We saw a little preview of Stan and Ollie, and you came out and said, "Oh, double act."
Well, because we both had that double act.
I mean, you know,
experience.
I wish my double act partner had died, but that's a different thing. I envy you so much, Les. But,
now,
I'd like him to live, but in, you know, some discomfort and pain. So it's
but that movie was, I think echoes of that.
Yeah, of course.
It's like a marriage,
yeah.
Isn't it? You know? And I remember, you know, that summer with Dustin, which was in Panto that he collapsed and died. But that summer before in Blackpool, on the opening night of the show, the show was rocking. We were topping the bill. We'd got what we wanted. We were topping the bill at a big summer season for 20 weeks, twice nightly.
Yeah.
You know, and the house was full. And this was the opening night. And the first half of the show went so well. And then he went, I don't feel well. They got a doctor in, and the doctor said, you've had a mild heart attack. And you've got to go to the hospital now. And he went, no, I'm finishing the show. And, you know, again, Laurel and Hardy. He went on in the second half, was brilliant. The show finished. They got an ambulance, took him to hospital down the pier. And I had to go and talk to all the dignitaries and, you know, oh, Dustin's, you know, he's just had to go off. And then I had to hold the fort for 3 weeks. And he didn't like it. Again, that echo of, you know, in that movie. See this movie, Stan and Ollie. It's fantastic. But, you know, that kind of idea of like, ooh, somebody's can work on their own without me. And, you know, and for when he came back, we had a little spat. And I remember one night going on stage and we weren't talking. We were doing the act, but we weren't talking to each other, you know, off stage. And I remember thinking, if this was to carry on, I couldn't do this. But we got over it, and it was just one of those things.
Well, it's a weird thing, you know. That is, me and Stu had a fight one day over something, you know, trivial. But we were going to do a gig that night, and then you come on stage, and you know, you're not talking to each other on stage, and you come on stage and you just do it all. And I think I sort of came off and said, "Oh, you know, we've had one fight in 10 years; it's fine."
Yeah,
and that was it. And then it was sort of over. So
it's the strangest feeling.
It's a weird thing, and it is that competitive. You're sort of competitive by it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's weird double acts where they seem to always get on. Mm. I mean, it's a stressful situation, obviously, and I think you need that. You need some kind of difference and spark between you to make that work. And so it is. Yeah,
I felt very sorry for Paul Chuckle just recently because a brother as well.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
As your lifelong partner.
No, it's insane. Well, and then you know, but also his whole career has been that act.
Yeah.
So I mean. It was a relatively a shorter time that you and Dustin worked together.
Yeah, and we've both been solo acts before.
Exactly.
But, you know, because we came into the public's consciousness as that double act, Eric Morecambe had just died, and Eric was, you know, kind of like, again, had been part of a double act for all those years. I think I find it very hard that going on stage, there was a sense of will he be able to cope. And that, it took a while for, I remember, you know, I opened my act with I'm Still Standing, I'm okay, don't worry. So, and then Family Fortunes came along, which was an absolute gift.
Yeah.
You were all trying to do, I bet you've been waiting to do it, because everybody gets game show Tourette's around me and feels they have to do it. Our survey said a bloody noise follows me everywhere. can't go around a supermarket with a everybody thinks they're the first ones to do it.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
But that was you know, again, but you followed, like, you know, and you sort of forget, you followed Max Bygraves and
Bob Monkhouse, yeah.
And yet, I think you're still the one that most people would associate with that show.
I was very lucky, though, because, you know, my blueprint was to watch lots of Bob tapes. I thought, I've got to do what Bob does. Max was different. You've won a prize. Yeah, big money. There were 200 edits in one show. Because it wasn't his bag. It wasn't what he did, and Bob was the master of that kind of show. And I remember watching it and thinking, right, I've got to have a joke for every single member of both families, and that's not me either. And so the first series, you know, I think the first week I had a white suit. Looking back on some of those suits,
there's some great ones in the laughter show as well. Yellow you're wearing in the laughter show.
Well, you know. That first series, and we did 26 shows in 2 weeks, so you don't get time to kind of learn. And I was doing joke, and it only took me until, you know, you get a stupid answer, name an occupation that requires a torch, a burglar, you know, and name somewhere you might stand in a queue at the front, and name something that's pink, my cardigan. Yeah, it is, isn't it? Let's see if 100 people agreed with you on that one. It's when you get those, and suddenly you realise that, you know, just playing off that, you know, and in looking down the camera, and, you know, and one day I said, you know, if it's up there, I'll give you the money myself, and it got a laugh, and then the producer said, you should use that as a catchphrase. I said, I can't do that. I can't say that every time. He said, that's a catchphrase. Oh, yeah, okay. So I got a catchphrase. Yeah. And I realised that, you know, that was how the show worked. But, you know, it was a great show to do.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
no, 16 years I did of it.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Saturday night.
Are they showing that still?
It's still on Challenge.
Because I was sort of obsessed with watching all of those kind of, they're repeating all the 70s and 80s game shows. Bullseye, I would
Bullseye.
Just watch.
Yeah.
I'd watch them. We'd be the Edinburgh Fringe and there'd be all the entertainment in the world on offer, and I'd be watching back-to-back Bullseye on Challenge TV in my dressing gown.
Well, Jim came up to Edinburgh and do a one-man show about it?
Yes, he did. Yeah. Well, quite a few of the guys have come up and done I mean, obviously, have you ever done like a show about you, or have you've just done acting in Edinburgh?
No, it's funny. The three that I've done in Edinburgh have all been plays, but I really would like to maybe do like a little retrospective thing and just, you know, talk about me. I mean, because for a while I was, you know, after I went into the Big Brother house, not my biggest good decision, but I came second. But I was labelled as Les Miserables for a while, you know, and that became, you know, the stuff I had to cope with. But when I was in there, you know, just touching, I know you're probably going to ask me about Big Brother. Go on, do you want to ask me about Big Brother?
No, I don't.
Well, when I was in there,
And let me ask about Brother. Okay. What happened to Big Brother?
Well, I thought it would be funny to talk to the chickens, you see, but I thought it was a bit of comedy shtick, but I didn't know that they were summoning the psychologist. Les is in trouble. And I'd go out and sit and talk to the chickens and go, wait. But then, like, for instance, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of the editing to some extent. And remember, this was the first one. They did one for Comic Relief, with the one that Vanessa was in and Jack D escaped.
Yeah.
And then we were the first celebrity one on Channel 4. But there were only six of us in there, and it was only a 10-day show. And we didn't, honestly, well, unless the others did, and I was just stupid, I didn't get paid. It wasn't a fee. You didn't go in for a fee. You supposedly went in for charity. But, of course, you're not going in for charity. You're going to give yourself a little kickstart, you know, and reboot. Because the phone wasn't ringing, so it certainly wasn't ringing after. But because, like, Mark Owen was, you know, just, you know, he was saint-like and just lovely, Saint Mark, and just fantastic. And he won it, and I came second. But one afternoon, he got his guitar out and sang the Verve song, because the drugs don't work, you know. That, and I'm very suggestible. If somebody, you know, sings a song, it's in my head all day. So, but when it went out on telly, they cut out Mark sitting singing with his guitar, and then at the end of the show, as the titles are going across, there's me in the jacuzzi going, because the drugs don't work. They smirk you. So, you know, but then I came second, and Mark got through that whole experience by just tidying up.
Right.
You know, he loves to tidy up. He loves, you know, making tea and tidying the kitchen and making it spotless. And when we were sat there, just me and him sat like this, and there was a bottle of champagne in an ice bucket, and Davina, we're waiting for Davina to come and talk to us and say who's won or who's going. He said to me, he said, "You're going to win." I said, no, Mark, you are definitely going to win. He said, "No, I think it's you." He said, "Do me a favour." He said, if I win, when I go out, will you... put the bottle in the bin and wash the ice bucket." Look at him now.
It was you went through a difficult time that I think everyone knows about, and it's
well, I couldn't walk down the road with the dog without, you know, they just wanted that photo of me looking, you know, and you're trying to get your poo bag, and, you know, and they get that shot of
it's a weird thing about the showbiz and the papers.
Yeah.
And I think there was an element, really, where he had a much younger, very attractive wife.
Yeah.
And I think there was this element where they want, you know, they were waiting for it to go wrong.
They were waiting, yeah.
And I think probably it's interesting when on This Is Your Life, you're there, and like a couple of people go, "Oh, it's going to be great. The marriage is going to be great." In a way that, again, you wouldn't do to someone if you thought the marriage was going to be
that's
great.
Right.
Because you wouldn't need to say it. And so everyone was waiting for it to go wrong.
Yeah.
And but also
nobody told me.
But also but. But that element of...
I remember one day in our house in Highgate, and it was the Grand National Day, and the plumber was there to fix a washing machine, and Amanda came running and said, "We need to put a bet on." I went, "What? It's the Grand National." I said, "Okay, great." And 10 quid, and she went, "Oh, we need to put more than that." And I went, 20. And the plumber went, "Kids, eh?" maybe I should have known then. But you know what? It's kind of like we were together for 10 years. Yes, people forget that. It was 10 years, you know. And
but I think that's, you know, marriages go wrong in show business all the time. And, you know, I think people would just, well, they wanted it to go wrong so that they could go see it's gone wrong. And they want, you know, and then you have to be put through that. And that's, it's your real life and your personal life. And you're obviously living it a bit in the
Piers spotlight. Morgan. On the Daily Mirror, the Sunday Mirror, the last day before I came out of the Big Brother house, had a picture of me sitting like this there was a bench where I used to talk to the chickens. So there's me on a bench sitting like that, and the headline, or rather the whole page headline is this the most pathetic man in Britain? Right. So, you know, I kind of felt like I'd murdered somebody for a while, because, you know, once that all happened, or, you know, and there was stuff before that, I would have journalists outside my house from 6 o'clock in the morning, like six cars outside the house on a double yellow line. Nobody stopped them, nobody moved them, but they were there in cars waiting. You know, I was in Chicago at the moment, at that time, playing a cuckolded husband. Art and life. And I would come out of the front door and run to get into my mate's car, and photographers were bouncing off the front of the car, you know. And kind of like, I thought, when I'd have to go out and then get in the car, and I'd be chased, you know, by car. I became the best getaway driver in London, you know, because I could get away from the press. But I had to do that, you know.
But so it's very difficult to overcome something like that, and then it's all, and everyone knows, and everyone's following it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a, again, it's a testament to you. First of all, when people say Piers Morgan, people go, I think if you weren't here and someone said Les Dennis, there would be a lovely reaction from an audience. You know what I mean? Fucking Piers Morgan, who thinks he's popular and, you know.
Thank you.
But
well, you know, yeah, I mean, you know.
Did you go on his show, though? You went on his...
No, I didn't.
No,
I didn't.
Because often that's happened where people have gone on the show and talked about
his... Life stories, no. Yeah. No, I didn't, no.
Oh, good. No. But and
I'll only go on a Thursday on Good Morning Britain. Thursday or Friday.
Oh, well, that's good.
Because lovely Ben's there.
Yes, he is. He's going to be a guest on a future show as well. I don't think we'll have Piers Morgan on. My last interaction with Piers Morgan was I tweeted a thing about him being a fascist enabling cunt. And I think I just retweeted it, I think, but he said, would you say that? You come and say that to my face. I said, I'll happily say it to your face. Yeah. He was just about to go to America, so...
Okay.
I might get him on just to call him a fascist neighbour and come to his face and see what he does, because he seemed to be implying he would punch me in the face for doing that, which I think would be...
He might come on just to do that.
Yeah, well, that'd be good. Yeah. Good for the show. Yeah. I don't mind getting punched.
I kind of had to get through all that, and, you know, that's what I did, and, you know, if I hadn't done Big Brother and all that stuff hadn't happened in my life, then Ricky Gervais wouldn't have called me and invited me onto Extras, where, you know, I was playing, as he called it, a twisted, demented version of myself.
Yeah.
Which was a pitch. How would you like to come on and play a twisted, demented version of yourself? And there's an arse shot. So, you know, I just thought, well, he referenced Larry Sanders and Curb Your Enthusiasm, two of my favourite shows, and he said, look, you'll be lampooning yourself. So I went absolutely with Extras. And, you know, people, my friends were like, you know, are you letting him, you know, are you sure you're not going to get kind of stitched up? And I got the script and I read it and I went, no, I'm not. And, you know, and Ricky always said that, like, you even added things. Like, at the end of the episode, because there's me and him sitting there, he goes, like, what about there? And I said, I'm not going, and in the show he says, I'm not ending up with that pissed up slapper. And I ended up, you know, at the end of the show, I'm in the dark and we're in bed. And it was written that I said to her, I don't really know. And she goes, what? And I go, I don't really know, again. And I went, at rehearsals, I said, what if, instead of repeating, I don't really know, what if I say, if it's up there, I'll give you the money myself? And he went, we're having that. And in typical Ricky fashion, said, you're not getting a writing credit, but we're having it. So, you know, if I hadn't done that, then, you know, I know it was a chance for me to reinvent and smash that Les Miserables, you know, thing. But when I was walking through Liverpool a few weeks after, this woman came up to me and she went, you all right now, lad? And I went, yeah, what do you mean? She went, after that documentary about your life. So she thought, you know, in a documentary, I was in a dressing room with Ricky Gervais toweling myself while he's going, oh, what is that light switch about? What is that?
It was, you know, it was a gamble for you, though.
And it was a gamble, yeah.
I think the stuff he's doing with all those things, yeah. It is treading a line, and you're never quite sure what he himself thinks.
I went to Afterlife, which is his new one, and it is amazing.
Yeah.
It's as dark, and as, you know, you watch it from behind the sofa rather than, you know, like all of his stuff, but it's hilarious and very moving. And, you know, this idea that, you know, he plays a guy who has lost his wife and just thinks there's no point in living anymore. So he says what he feels. Yeah. He tells everybody what he feels. I think it's going to be, I've seen 2 episodes of 6.
Cool.
It's great.
Yeah. I think what I like about your stuff is that, you know, when you did This Is Your Life again, that all the Coronation Street people were on it and wanted to be part of it. And Mavis was joining in, saying, I don't know if it's you or me doing this anymore. Yeah. And so, you know, you're prepared to be the butt of the joke, but you're not, it's not any cruel humor. No. So people are flattered if
Dennis Law was on my This Is Your Life, which is because, you know, my family were a big Man United family. Supporters, even though we're Scousers, and my dad played for Liverpool, but my mum was a big fan of, you know, the whole kind of romanticism of the Busby Babes and Munich and all that stuff. She became a Man United fan then, and she in fact came up with my stage name, because my real name is Leslie Heseltine, and she suggested that Les Dennis was like Dennis Law backwards, so, you know,
right.
That was kind of that. So he came on, and sadly my mum and dad weren't around to enjoy that moment, but, you know. Yeah. Doddy came on, which was, you know.
Well, all these people. Yeah. What I like, I was reading about you. You were on New Faces, which you did win, and you nearly got 120 points, but Tony Hatch docked you 1 point.
He docked me 1 point, but we're friends now. And Tony was, you know what? I didn't mind Tony doing that, because Arthur Askey would give everybody 10 and have nowhere to go. You know, because if he liked somebody particularly, he had nowhere to go.
Sure.
And Tony Hatch was like the Simon Callow of his day. Simon Callow? Cowell.
It's like Simon Callow.
The Simon Callow of his day. But it was, you know.
But I love the fact that, you know, I love it when two generations kind of clash. I love the fact Arthur Askey was a judge on that program. Yeah. Generalized.
Yeah.
When you think the idea that you and him could overlap. I mean, obviously you did, but it's,
well, you know it's not that. Only on that. I then did his radio show at the Paris studios,
right.
and I was on with Arthur Askey and Sandy Powell.
Right.
So, you know, and Max Wall I've worked with, and I just mentioned Doddy became a friend, you know, and, you know, he always used to call me young juvenile. And he gave me tax advice once. No, honestly, he did. He said, I was saying about staying in Diggs. He said, don't stay in Diggs. Stay in a nice hotel. You can afford it. It comes off your tax. But the story that...
No, if you don't pay it, though, it doesn't come.
The story that Donnie told me that I, you know, love, we were literally, it was the 2008 celebrations in Liverpool for Capital Culture. And we were standing ready to go out and, you know, and loads of people from Liverpool were going out and standing on the steps of St. George's Hall. And he said to me, he said, I had a hernia, you know, young juvenile. And everybody was upset because they thought I was in hospital. But I was there in the on the operating theatre, and the surgeon said to the anaesthetist, he said, give him a bit more. He said, I can't give him any more. He said, well, give him a bit more. He said, all right, give him a bit more. He said, a bit more. He said, I can't give him any more. He said, you can. 5 hours in the theatre. Let's see how he fucking likes it. Which I love that he did that about himself.
Yeah, yeah. But that's, you know, it's being able to laugh at yourself.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know, I love this reinvention and chop, you know, and riding the waves and getting over the storms. And now what you're doing is, I mean, it's sort of beautiful now, the life story, again, looking back.
Yeah.
Because I think the stuff you're doing now, as a result of that, of doing extras, maybe partly, but you were always doing a bit of acting. But you're sort of now like, you're working at the RSC now?
Yes, not the RAC, the RSC. Which, I mean, when I got this opportunity this year, and you know, I have the most amazing family support from my wife Claire and my kids, you know, got a grown-up son, Philip, and I've got two little ones now. I'm kind of... I remember when Eleanor was born, Barry Cryer saying to me, he said, 55 is a good age to be a new dad because you're up three times a night anyway. but I have this amazing support, so I'm able to go and do these things. You know, like, you know, this is my first summer season since I did that Blackpool summer right. season, but this is quite a different summer season. I'm at the Swans Theatre with two plays. I'm in The Provoked Wife, which is a restoration comedy by Vanbrugh, and I'm in a restoration tragedy by Thomas Otway called Venice Preserved, and that's a real kind of Lear-like tragic part for me, sure. which is, you know, when I was 17, I went with the school to Stratford, and I remember seeing this actor, Emrys James, play Feste, and just being blown away by the power and going, oh, and I've started doing the clubs, maybe I should go to drama school, maybe I should go down this route. And I didn't, and I always wanted to get back to it. And so, you know, again, I was fortunate with Family Fortunes that we did three shows in a week. So I was able to then go off and go and do a rep play, you know, for Equity Minimum, you know, and earn my stripes as an actor. So for me to be at the RSC now is just, it's just one of those, I'd say, bucket list. It is a bucket list, but it's, you know, it's a life fulfillment, really. It's something that's come and I'm so excited about.
Yeah,
you know?
No, so that's going to be over the summer.
Right through the summer. We open in May and we play in rep with the two plays. So, you know, one afternoon you might come and see, you know, the restoration comedy, which is a wonderful comedy by Vanbrugh, who was an architect who built Castle Howard. Is it Castle Howard? The house in Castle Howard. Castle Howard in where they filmed *Brideshead Revisited*. You know, so he architect and Royal Naval College, Greenwich.
Yeah.
You know, worked on that and wrote plays. He was a slacker, wasn't he? you know, it's just amazing, and you know, working with amazing actors.
Yeah. You know? And if there's, well, there's, I mean, there's so much to talk about which we were not going to get round to, but you've done this great play written by my mate Danny Robbins, End of the Pier, which is it's sort of what we've been talking about. It's about that, the generations of comedy.
I think
it's interesting because I think the 70s hit the 80s and there were some casualties amongst the comedians, and some got over the fences if it's the Grand National. And I think we're sort of hitting that again a little bit now. I think there's again changes in taste that some people aren't going to be able to adapt to, and some people don't want to adapt to.
No.
I mean, Bernard Manning kept working until the end, didn't he? And
he did, and
for a long time.
And if he hadn't done the stuff he'd done, you'd say he was a brilliant comedian because he was a great. You know, his timing and his ability. He was a funny man, but it just was, you know, questionable what he talked about.
Yeah. But it's, so the play's about that. It's about a father and son. Are you going to be doing this again, this play?
We're hoping to, It was one of those shows that kind of crept up on the audience there because it was the three W's. It was the World Cup and it was Wimbledon and it was the weather. We had that amazing weather. And this play went in and after, it was a five-week run. After the first 2 weeks was slow, but then, you know, the reviews came in and they were good. And then the last 3 weeks, we were selling standing seat tickets. Yeah. And what I got a kick out of was that lots of comics came to see it, you know, and the comics that I love now, you know. So that was great, you know. And it was based on this old comic who was part of a double act who had made a mistake in a club and had been seen by a Guardian journalist. They're making this mistake and his career went down the pan. His son comes to visit him and has maybe made a mistake that has been caught on Twitter.
Right. Yeah.
So it's all about that Twitter storm. It's about, you know, the kind of comedy then and now, but also about the world of politics and race and everything. It's a really smart and clever play by Danny Robbins. You know, just loved it. And Blake Harrison played my son. Tyler Gouveia played his girlfriend. And there were only four of us in it. And Nitin Ganatra was... Nitin Ganatra, who, you know, people would know from EastEnders, has never done stand-up, and he had to do a 10-minute stand-up every night, and was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, it was really great.
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, I hope we'll get to see that again.
Yeah.
I didn't watch Coronation Street, and I know you're in Coronation Street for a couple of years.
Yeah.
It sounds like a very interesting character arc that I just want to discuss. Your character tried to burgle Gail's house.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you married her.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you split up after she lied to you.
Yeah, about my son who wasn't my son.
Okay.
Does
the attempted burglary wasn't... you got over that hump in the relationship.
Yeah, I did. But, you know, I remember on the first day, kind of like somebody hadn't informed the vision mixer that I was playing this burglar. At that time, he was just the burglar. He wasn't Michael yet. So, you know, and I turned up at the window and she went, "That's Les Dennis." And people, again, on social media were saying, why, when Gail is going through, you know, the identikits of this burglar, why doesn't she just say to him, "He looks like Les Dennis"? But, you know, I'm married...
Yeah,
Gail, right, and Gail? You know, I was husband number. I wasn't. Well, people think I'm husband number six. I'm husband number five. But you know, she married Brian Tilsley twice. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of Gail warnings, weren't there? You know, I mean, literally, you know, does Rose Kennedy have a black dress? You could apply that to Gail Tilsley. that whole idea of, you know, this woman who's unlucky in love, and I was number six, and I was.
And but then, don't marry a burglar. That's my advice. Don't marry someone who's burgling you. Oh, you'll do. You get your handy. You're here.
But then I got killed, or did I get killed? I got allowed to die by... Does everybody know? I mean,
spoilers, anybody, man. Come on. I'm not that episode yet.
It's not a spoiler because he's gone as well. By Phelan, the baddie in it. Anybody know Phelan, the baddie in Curry? Yeah. Two of you.
It was massive. My people don't watch Coronation.
Yeah. Well, but that the guy who played Phelan Connor, we got reinvented as in our agenda change as ugly sisters in Panto. we did Felina and Michaela last year in Manchester. So
terrific! And it's this full circle thing.
Well,
doing all your Coronation Street impressions and then being on Coronation
and then being
Street.
In it. Yeah,
it's
awesome.
Yeah. But that's what it's. Yeah. I think if
whose dream am I in?
I don't know, but it's amazing. It's wonderful that. You know, like I say, I think the longer I do this, if we can call this a job, all of my career, you know, it's just still being there is an achievement for anyone who kind of manages to stay there. So to stay there and be reinventing yourself and doing different stuff and being able to, you know, be able to do Family Fortunes and the RSC.
Yeah.
There's not many people who could achieve that.
No, there's not. So, but funnily enough, in The Provoked Wife, Caroline Quentin and myself are in it. So Caroline started as a dancer on the end of the pier with Bernie Clifton.
Wow.
So we've been kind of both...
You thought you were going to say in The Provoked Wife, they're playing Family Fortunes. Funny enough, Caroline Quentin plays the host of Family Fortunes. I think over a very long time.
Yeah.
Look, it's been absolutely marvellous to have
lovely.
You here.
Thanks
great. So much
Thank
for coming
you.
On. And I'm sure there's another 20 or 30 years in you yet. Who knows what will come up
who
next?
Knows? Yeah, absolutely.
Unbelievably. I mean, you're still in my mind, you're still like 25 and you still look like you could be 25. But you're not.
No, I'm not. No,
don't forget it.
66 this year, so, you know, it's coming up. Yeah, it's getting there.
Sorry to end on a downer there. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the 66-year-old Les Dennis. You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Rich Tarring, and my guest, Les Dennis. Come on.
The music's by Pest. Thank you to everyone at Acast, to everyone at the Square Theatre, to everyone at GoFasterStrike.com. They do some great DVDs and downloads and books there. Why not pop along and see them? I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. Thank you very much for listening to You at Home too. This is a Go Faster Stripe, Sky Potato and Fuzz production. Go to rahalaspa.co.uk to find out much more about this podcast and get access to all sorts of secret behind-the-scenes stuff and ad-free podcasts and everything at rahalaspa.co.uk, and go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Rahalaspa is coming near to your town or even in your town, probably in a theatre. It'll be cool, my friends, my fan friends.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.